Thank you, Juan, and thank you for the invitation. It's very nice to be here, a rather stimulating environment. In today's talk, I will describe, I will discuss about mostly about quantum systems out of equilibrium, mostly strongly interacting system out of equilibrium. And my talk will be mostly methodological, in the sense that I will discuss, for example, this time-dependent rational Monte Carlo approach and the neural network quantum states. So I will try to explain you and to introduce you to some of the methods that we've devised in the last years to tackle some interesting problems in out-of-equilibrium physics. So, first of all, this work I'm going to discuss today has been done in collaboration with a lot of people. A few of them you can see listed here from France, Italy, United States, and Switzerland, of course. What's the problem, the general problem I'm interested in? So what kind of methods I would like to discuss, and what kind of methods have we devised in the recent years? So first of all, the general problem that I would like to address and I will discuss today is the problem of studying, let's say, the time evolution of some pure state, so an isolated pure state, which it's this psi here, on which we imagine that we act with some time-dependent Hamiltonian h of t. So this external, this is some Hamiltonian h of t. So the assumption that I will make during this talk is that this perturbation, this time-dependent Hamiltonian, if you want, is not necessarily a small one. So typically, I will be interested actually in cases where this perturbation is rather large. So I'll be interested in nonlinear effects, if you want. And also, I will assume that this time evolution is purely unitary. So in the following, I will neglect, for example, the effects due to the dissipation and other effects which arise from non-unitary dynamics. So these are basically the only two assumptions I make. However, there's, as you can imagine, a lot of problems which fall into this wide class of out of equilibrium quantum dynamics. And in particular, there are two, I would say, more broad classes. So the first one is the so-called quantum quenches. So quantum quenches are just a fancy word to say something relatively easy, in the sense that in this case, in this situation, you imagine to prepare some many-body state, psi, so in, for example, as the ground state of some given Hamiltonian. And then at some point, let's say time t equals zero, you act with some Hamiltonian, which is not the one you have prepared your state with, but some different Hamiltonian. For example, you can imagine that you change instantaneously the interaction strength in your Hamiltonian. And then you study the unitary evolution induced by this new Hamiltonian as a function of time. These kind of problems are really interesting because can allow us to address a lot of fundamental questions. For example, we would like to understand if after some time that we have driven our system strongly out of equilibrium, it will eventually fall to some effective equilibrium state again. And in particular, we would like to understand if after some time this quasi-equilibrium state, this equilibrium state that will reach is compatible, for example, with the standard prescription of statistical mechanics, and in particular, if we can talk about temperature in the system, even though it's an isolated system, but in principle, we could still talk about temperature. So this is rather a fundamental question, as you can see. But it's a fundamental question to which we don't know, actually, I would say, reliable answers in a lot of interesting cases, and in particular in a high-dimensional system. Then there is another class of problems which are instead characterized by purely time-dependent Hamiltonian, where we still deal with some unitary dynamics. And these kind of problems have themselves some kind of fundamental interest. For example, you can imagine that you tune some control parameter in your Hamiltonian slowly or fast in your as a function of time, and you cross a phase transition, and you can ask yourself what's the rate of production of defects when you cross this phase transition. So the Keeble-Zurek mechanism, for example. Also, this kind of problems is very interesting for adiabatic quantum computing, as I will try to say a little bit more later. So it's clear that this field of the out of equilibrium dynamics of quantum is a relatively rich field where there's a lot of questions to try to address. However, the point is that as we try to answer to this question, to analyze this time evolution, especially in the presence of strong interactions, we immediately find that there is an important challenge ahead. And the reason is that the methods that we have available nowadays to study the dynamics of these quantum systems are relatively limited. For example, if you rely on exact approaches, let's say exact generalization, you certainly don't know that you're limited to very small systems. You can study only a few spins, for example, of order 20, at most 30 if you are really good. But you cannot, for example, assess thermodynamic properties, which are of interest, for example, if you want to understand whether your system thermalizes or not. So the questions I was discussing a little bit earlier. Also, you know that if you want to study unitary dynamics with path integral Monte Carlo, you are immediately in trouble. And the reason is that you have a severe phase problem. So, in other words, the way you use if you try to write a path integral representation of the unitary dynamics, you cannot interpret it anymore as a probability distribution, and you cannot sample it exactly as you do instead for equilibrium thermal properties. So, you cannot use path integral Monte Carlo. Also, for example, you can imagine to do something simple like mean field dynamics. And typically, mean field dynamics is not very accurate. I would say even qualitatively not accurate in most of the interesting situations. For example, typically because it lacks relaxation channels and the interactions between quasi-particles, which are typically responsible for thermalization in this out of equilibrium system. So even mean field dynamics is not an option if you want to study interesting problems. Then you, of course, have tensor network methods, which are a great methods to study the out of equilibrium dynamics of one-dimensional system, mostly. But however, as you certainly know, these methods are somehow limited only to one-dimensional lattice systems. And their extension to high dimensions and also to continuous space problems is still a matter of research, active research, which, however, has not found yet conclusive solution, I would say. So you immediately see that there's a lot of interesting regimes, so systems in continuous space and high-dimensional systems, even on a lattice, which are hard to reach with existing technology. So what can we do better? So what I will try to do today is to convince you that one can use some variational approach, and in particular this time-dependent variational Monte Carlo method, which is the general framework for what I'm going to talk about in the following. And this variational approach in conjunction with, for example, these Jastrow feedback states that I'm going to talk about, and these neural network quantum states can allow us to really study those regimes and those systems which have been traditionally inaccessible by state-of-the-art methods. So I would say that at least with this approach we can try to answer and to provide reliable answers to many interesting regimes which have been traditionally hard to reach. So let's start with the general method. Since it's a variational method, I guess it's good to start with the static variational principle, which I'm sure everybody knows here. In particular, the static variational principle tells you that if you have a quantum Hamiltonian H and some state which depends on some parameters, which I call here alpha, this principle tells you that the best possible description of the ground state is obtained when you minimize the expectation value of the energy with respect to this set of variational parameters up. So that's so far so good. So you have a clear strategy to obtain the best ground state wave function. However, probably not all of you know, there is also an extension of this approach, which is less well known, I would say, to the time-dependent case. This dates back to Dirac and Frankel, so it's a rather old variational principle as well, which in modern terms can be rephrased as follows. So imagine that you want to study the unitary dynamics with some time-dependent variational state this psi var of t, which has some time-dependent variational state inside, so which I call alpha of t. What happens is that you can see that on one hand you will have that the variational dynamics is induced by basically a linear combination of these operators of k, which are the derivatives of the wave function with respect to these variational parameters. So in a sense, the variational dynamics is induced lies in a subspace in the Hilbert space, which is spanned by these variational vectors. And on the other hand, you have the exact dynamics, which is just given by Schrödinger, the time-dependent Schrödinger equation. So what you can do, and what you can do to find the best possible time evolution for these variational parameters, is to minimize the distance in the Hilbert space between these two time derivatives of the variational and of the exactly evolved state. So that's the time-dependent variational principle. That's just a way to see what I've said before for, let's say, two-dimensional Hilbert space. So you have like, this is the original vector that you have. This one is the exactly evolved one with the Heisenberg, with the Schrödinger equation, and this one is the variational state. So what you want to do is to minimize actually the angle between these two. And the good distance to do that, one can show that if one doesn't deal with a normalized state, is the so-called Fubini study distance, which is insensitive to the state's normalization. So you can do that, and you obtain some closed equations of motion for these variational parameters. So at each time, you have that these time derivatives of the variational parameters have to satisfy this closed system of a linear system of equation, where, as you can see, we still have this matrix which contains correlations of the. This is nothing but the matrix, if you want, induced by these variational operators O, and on the other side, you have the action of the Hamiltonian, which enters because of the exact or the fact that you're trying to minimize the distance with the exact evolution.
So, can you say what O is again?
Yeah. So probably. Yeah. Sorry. So O is the derivative of the wave function with respect to a given variational parameter divided by psi. So it's the derivative of the log of the wave function, if you want, with respect to some one of my variational parameters. Or, yeah. So it's a vector. If you have n parameters, this O will have sites n, and each entry is the derivative of the wave function with respect to each of these parameters. So, and an important feature of these equations of motion is that they are symplectic. One can easily show these, and also that they exactly conserve the energy. If you have a time-independent Hamiltonian, they satisfy the Effenfest theorem for these operators O, which I call, roughly speaking, entangling operators.
I'm a little bit confused. What is the average of O now? Like, how do you, this O is an?
It's an operator.
But is it living in the Hilbert space of the original state? I'm confused here.
So that's the definition of O. So let's say that X is some many-body basis that you have chosen, yeah. Right? So it's the time derivative, if you want, of the amplitude of psi on this particular many-body state, many-body configuration you've chosen, with respect to the variational parameters.
Okay.
So these operators, as I've written them, are diagonal, if you want, in the many body basis I've chosen. For example, in the spin SZ basis, if you have spins.
Are they always there?
Well, in this formulation, yes, but. So again, yeah, you can imagine them as the generators of the variational dynamics, and this is clear from this definition, I think, from just the time derivative of the variational state. So this time-dependent variational Monte Carlo approach goes as follows. So at some time, at some fixed time t, you sample the square modulus of the wave function, so with a standard variational approach, standard variational Monte Carlo approach. And here you can see that you don't have any sign problem because you are sampling the square modulus of the wave function. And then you measure the expectation values of those operators which enter the equations of motion that I've written before here. So you measure the expectation values of these quantities, which can be easily done in the Monte Carlo context. And once you've done that, you can solve this linear equation, linear system of equations for these variational the derivative, the time derivatives of these variational parameters. Once you've done that, then you can just use some standard ODE scheme to integrate the equations of motion in time. And you can go to next time and integrate up to some given time. So that's the time-dependent variational Monte Carlo approach, which of course must be, where of course to specify it in, concretely, one has to specify also the states I'm using to do the dynamics. But this is the general approach, okay? So let's talk about the states, actually, because until now I've been rather general, but it's, this approach makes sense if you have strongly correlated states, which can describe fairly enough, fairly well interacting systems. If I did the same reasoning with mean field states, that would not be interesting at all, actually. So the interest is that we can use this scheme in conjunction with some correlated states, which can describe systematically, I would say, some strongly correlated phases. And the first class of states that we have used with this approach and which I would like to discuss today are the so-called Jastrow-Feinberg states. So these states look like that. For example, if you take some spin Hamiltonian, for example, you have a spin 1/2 Hamiltonian, and you choose as a many body basis the sigma z many body basis, you have, so you have a lattice of L sites, say. So this way of writing the wave function is nothing but an effective expansion in the correlations you have among your spin variables. So for example, you can have, so this will be, for example, the one body term, and this J1 of I will be my one body variational parameters. So then I can have two body correlations among this sigma I and sigma j, and this will be my additional variational parameters. So free body and so on. So you can see that this has an effective, as a systematic, if you want, expansion of the wave function in terms of correlations. And the idea, I mean, the understanding that that Feinberg gave of this wave function is that typically in most of the physical Hamiltonians of interest, since you only have two-body interactions, the effective correlations that must be included explicitly in the wave function are typically comprise only a small number of bodies. So if you have two-body interactions, you can very well describe the physics of the system, including only up to three or at most four bodies, typically, in most of the situations one can think of. So this expansion typically converges very fast. Then this approach can be also extended, as we've done recently in the time-dependent case, to systems in continuous space. So in this case, for example, if you have some field Hamiltonian in 1D, for example, so this object basically become, if you want, continuous fields of this continuous variable x, or of this, or they can become like a two-dimensional function of the x y and x j and etc. for high-order correlations. So this expansion is rather general and can be performed not only for spins and bosons but also for fermions. For example, in this paper, in the group of Imada, they've extended this approach. They applied our approach to study also lattice fermions in the time-dependent case. And in this case, what they've done is just to impose the antisymmetry of the wave function via a Slater determinant, and then add some time dependence in the Jastrow case and also in the orbitals that you put in the Jastrow in the Slater determinant. So, yeah.
How far can you go in practice in the number of terms that you?
Yeah, that's a good point. In practice, we have arrived we've used up to four bodies typically, which is typically more than enough in decent Hamiltonian, decent applications. But there might be cases where one might need more, and that's the reason also why one would like to use other more advanced states like the neural network quantum states I'm going to discuss after. So that's, yeah, that's the main point, I would say. So I will now overview some a few applications very quickly of this approach. So time-dependent variational Monte Carlo with these Jastrow Feedback states truncated to some three or four bodies. And in particular to some problems which concern the thermalization of ultra-cold atoms. For example, what we studied in this paper was were quantum quenches in the Bose-Haber model, both in one and two dimensions, which is the most, if you want, interesting case because it has never been studied beyond the mean field regime. And what we do here is that we prepare the system. We prepare the system in the ground state of this Bose-Haber Hamiltonian in a regime where typically the interactions are small. For example, we can prepare them in a superfluid phase where U is relatively small, and then at time t equals zero, we turn on stronger interactions and we quench this state with this final Hamiltonian. So with some final value of the interaction U. For example, you can see here results for the time evolution. So this is, again, real time as a function of two different values of the interaction strength. So here we are quenching from the superfluid strongly into the MOT phase. So you have for 20 and 40. So we are really going inside the MOT phase. And you can see here a comparison between this is the interaction energy, so basically this part here, as a function of time, and then compared with some TDMRG calculations. So you can see that the accuracy one can get is rather good. There are some small differences, probably due to the fact that we use periodic boundaries and the MRG simulation used open boundaries. And in this case, we went up to four bodies in our wave function. And the reason is that physically, when you excite your system inside the MOT phase, you excite Doblon-Doblon's excitations, which are intrinsically four-body excitations. So that's the reason why one has to go to up to four bodies. Then we've done the same study. Those were results in 1D, of course, because we compared with the MRG to see the accuracy. Then we've done the same study in two dimensions on a square lattice. And what we found, which is pretty interesting, is that if you quench to small values of the interaction strength, for example, in this case, the asymptotic value reached after some relatively long time is fairly well described by the thermal distribution. I'm afraid you cannot see it very well from these plots, but there are these horizontal lines here. And these horizontal lines are nothing but the expectation value of these quantities computed at the effective temperature fixed by the conservation of the energy. So the conservation of the energy fixes one and only one temperature. So you can compare these quantities with those you get computing the expectation values a la Boltzmann at that temperature. And you can see that if the quench is not that large, you really relax to this thermal equilibrium state. However, if you do a larger quench, what happens is that your asymptotic value is more and more different from these thermal values. For example, this is the thermal values here, and this is you see that my dynamics is going to something which is slightly larger than the one that the thermalization is telling me. So the reason for that is that when you cross the phase transition, when you cross the MOT transition, you will have a lot of excitations of the MOT phase, which will not decay and which will stay as long-lived excitations in your system. And the amount of excitation you have increases as a function of the final interaction strength. And we've analyzed and understood this phenomenon also in terms of some metastable and glassy dynamics in the system. So I don't have time to go into the details of that, but if you are interested, we can discuss about that later. Then we've used this approach also to study systems in continuous space. So in particular, we take the Liebig-Linzer model, which is, let's say, the prototypical model for interacting spins, interacting bosons in one dimension in a continuous space, which also well describes quantum gases, ultra-cold gases in 1D. So what we do in this case is that we prepare the system into some phase at small values of g. Typically, these results are for the initial value of g of zero. So we start with an ideal BC. And then we quench to some final value of the interaction and see, for example, the evolution of the two-body density-density correlations at the instance zero, so this G2 of zero correlation. And here we can compare our results. These were obtained only with the two-body ansatz, so there's still room for improvement. With the exact result one can get with the Betti ansatz solution of this system, but only for a small number of particles. And you can see that our results already at the two-body level are relatively good agreement, especially at small values of the quench, with the exact solution of the given by the Betti ansatz.
So what happens if you go with gamma to infinity? Will you get better or worse?
This thing goes to zero exactly, because it fermionizes.
Yeah.
So you should look at other quantities like momentum distribution.
But you can
do that.
But would you expect that your method will, you know, get better again at this point?
Or? For the ground state, it does, because the wave function is a Tonks wave function, is a Girardot wave function, which can be written exactly as a two-body adjuster. For the dynamics, the situation is more intricate, and I would say that it would get worse because you have a lot of multi-body excitations,
okay,
which is a peculiar feature of 1D. But in 2D, this won't happen. So I would say that this approach is very accurate up to the two-body ansatz is very accurate up to gamma is equal to 4 or something. Then you can lose a little bit of accuracy, but yeah, still. So also, I mean, then we can do the same analysis, but on much larger systems, which cannot be studied with other approaches, basically. And for example, for quenches from zero to final value of gamma, we studied the behavior of these two-body correlations as a function for different values of gamma f, of the final interaction strength. And what we find in this case is that the system never reaches the equilibrium state given by the Boltzmann distribution, and the reason is that since this model is integrable, you have a lot of integrals of motion, the better rapidities in this case, which do not allow you to reach the Boltzmann equilibrium, but something which is more complex called the generalized Gibbs ensemble. So in general, this equilibrium state is not described by the Boltzmann distribution. What we found, and which is rather surprising, is that instead, if you start with some interacting state, for example, if you start with gamma I, so the initial interaction is equal to 4, and you quench to some final value of the interaction, which is still finite, instead the agreement between the thermal distribution and these asymptotic values is still good again, which is somehow surprising, but probably due to the fact that we are far from the super integrable point that we were studying here, which is an initial state where you don't have at all any interactions, which was somehow a very peculiar and very integrable state. So here, somehow, the effect on non-integrability is somehow washed out. So I will discuss quickly, because I'm already running late, this part. So in particular, we did some other applications to information spreading and locality in Bose and spin systems. So what we wanted to study here in particular is that what happens and how fast some correlation can develop in a system which has been quenched, for example. And the idea is that if you have some local Hamiltonian, Hamiltonian which only contains local terms, the velocity at which the information can spread in the system is bounded by a light cone given by this form. And this is the so-called Lib-Robinson bound, Lib-Robinson theorem. So despite the fact that the quantum mechanics is an intrinsically non-local theory, if you want, the fact that you still have a local Hamiltonian with only local interactions implies that the information cannot spread apart from some exponentially suppressed corrections faster than some linear velocity, if you will, some linear light cone. However, the same result does not hold for long-range Hamiltonians. For example, imagine that you have some interaction going like that with some exponent alpha. And in this case, we don't know, for example, if alpha is small, whether we still have locality in the system, so if correlation still spreads locally as for the long-range Hamiltonians. So okay, in the 1D case, we found a very nice light cone effect. We characterized the velocities at which this spreading happens for bosons. So I would say that there were rather no surprises for this on this thing. The interesting thing is, I would say that we could study this phenomenon also in two dimensions. So we could see how information can spread in two dimensions. And the interesting feature that we found is that the spreading of correlations as a function of time can follow some intricate anisotropic path, which depend on the lattice structure of the lattice you are using. So, for example, you can see that these correlations as a function of time increase. So, correlations develop at larger distances, but they do it in an asymmetric way, which reflects the fact that your Hamiltonian in this case contains only hopping to nearest neighboring sites. Another interesting point that I will just flash, result that I will just flash, so if you're interested we can discuss about that later, is that instead if you have some long-range Hamiltonian, so if you have some extended Bose-Hubbard model with some exponent alpha for the long-range interactions, the surprising thing that we found in this case is that even if the exponent alpha is small, for example, if you see here the case of alpha 1 alpha, so you have a rather long-range interaction, you can still see a light cone effect. So you can see here on this color plot, as a function of the distance and as a function of time, the value of the two-body density-density correlations. And you can see that still here nothing happens until this linear region, which is delimited by this light cone. And it's the same, which happens also for larger values of alpha. And the reason for this rather surprising result, I would say, that I didn't expect at all, is that the modes which carry infinite velocity, if you want, which would propagate your signal with infinite velocity, are strongly suppressed. So we did a quasi-particle analysis of this phenomenon and understood that the weight that these modes carry are strongly suppressed with respect to the local modes. So again, I can discuss with you more details about that later. Now, as Juan was already anticipating, the point, if you want, the problem with those Jastrom Friedberg states is that there is always the doubt, if you want, that you haven't included enough correlations, that you have not added enough bodies in your systematic expansion of the wave function. So how can you convince yourself that instead you have a really accurate and really systematic way of studying the system, the dynamics or even the ground state property of a generic system let's say, in arbitrary dimension? So that's the reason why very recently we have introduced this neural network quantum state. So this is the strong motivation, if you want. And since these neural network quantum states strongly build upon neural networks, I guess it's kind of good to recall, or at least to give a very rough introduction to what neural networks are. So neural networks are, if you want, some idealization of the brain, which can be idealized and modeled as a circuit, as a strongly nonlinear circuit, which takes some input, for example, these x values here, and then after some nonlinear operations, so going through this network of a lot of synapses and connections, will output some other quantities. So this f1, f2, f3. So this is a really rough idealization of the brain, of course, but which is at the heart, if you want, of artificial neural network. So you can see an artificial neural network as something which takes some input, so this state here, and after some nonlinear circuit will return the value of the result of the computation of this high, very high dimensional function. So this is really in brief, what a neural network is. Of course, this is a very rough approximation for the actual brain, and it is as bad as assuming that a cow is spherical, in the sense that from the point of view of the biology, the brain is much more complicated than a simple multidimensional function. So there will be other interactions with the environment, etc. But let's say at order zero, and from a physicist's perspective, it's rather fair to say that we can assume that the brain is just a highly complicated function in many dimensions. And this function will depend parametrically, if you want, on the weights, so which are the connection between these neurons inside the brain. Now, just to give you a taste of how we can use these artificial neural networks, probably you certainly already know that we can. One of the most used cases where these neural networks really make the difference and are very useful is, for example, for classification purposes. So the idea is that we have this high-dimensional function, which depends parametrically on these weights V, W, which are the connections among these artificial neurons. And what we can do is that we can consider this function as something which take as an input, for example, some image bits. So, for example, we can feed to this artificial neural network the picture of famous scientists, as you can see here. And we can train this network to learn which scientist is which. For example, we can feed to this network some given images that we know, for example, representing Feynman or Fermi, and we can tell, oh, look, this image which has these specified image bits represent Feynman, and these ones instead represent Fermi. So this is the so-called training phase. So we can fit, if you want, the network weights, so the connections among these artificial neurons, to reproduce the fact that this guy is Feynman, this guy is Feynman. So then the interesting point, of course, is that there will be a generalization phase where we can feed to this neural network an image that has never been seen before, and the neural network will tell us, according to his approximation, whether the image we've given him at this point is actually Feynman or Fermi. So that's the point, that we can generalize what we gave him. So this approach is what has been recently used by Juan and Roger Melko, and also by Lei Wang sometime later, for example, to classify phases of matter. For example, the idea here is that you can train your artificial neural network, giving him some input some configurations which represent some phases of matter. For example, here you can see some ferromagnetic phases in the ASIC model, or some other configurations which instead represent disordered phases at high temperature. And this network is then able, when you feed it with some never seen before configurations, to tell you exactly whether you are inside the ferromagnetic phase or inside the other phase, without prior knowledge of the order parameter. So that's the interesting point. And the interesting point is that this approach can be used, for example, to study phases where you don't know the order parameter. Then there is another flavor of neural networks, which is the so-called reinforcement learning approach. So this way of learning, of teaching things to the neural networks, is somehow more involved than the previous one, in the sense that here there is some interactive action between the neural network and the external environment, if you want. So it's in the other case, we were just the neural networks were just passively seeing and looking at the pictures of Fermi or Feynman without doing any active actions on these images. Instead, in this case, and for example, this is what has been done recently by the Google team playing Go. Is that instead you have a more active behavior with respect to the external environment. And in particular, for example, you can a typical example of this reinforcement learning is when you try to play a game with an artificial neural network. So what you will do then is that you will play a game with the current game policy. So the game policy is nothing but a high-dimensional function, which, given the current state of the board, for example, in the game of Go, will tell you which one is the next move to do. And then you play the full game, obtain the final score, and if this final score is better than what is worse, then you change the game policy in some way. If it's good, then you probably keep it, but do also some other changes. So you can see that there is some kind of loop in which you try to improve upon your previous gaming strategy, playing a lot of games and trying to obtain what's the best strategy to beat, for example, a human player to this game. So in this case, the neural network is not fitted, if you want, with some actual images or something which is static, but it actually develops and improves itself on the go. So now, what are these neural network quantum states? These neural network quantum states are strongly inspired, if you want, by this last strategy, which is this this way of doing some interactive learning in the system. And the basic idea is that we identified the wave function, which is nothing but a high-dimensional function in the space of the spins, for example. So if you project your wave function onto some many-body bases, it's a high-dimensional function of the spin values. So we basically identified this many-body wave function with a neural network. A neural network which contains a lot of possibly weights, which represent the connections among these artificial neurons. And then there are, of course, many ways of doing that. And there are many ways of choosing the particular and specific way you connect your neurons and how you organize your artificial circuit to manipulate and to resemble this many-body wave function. So the way we've done it at this stage is just to use one of the simplest architectures that you can think of, which is this restricted Boltzmann machine, which is which consists of two layers. So a visible layer, which contains basically the spin variables. So I fixed the value of the spin on some on all of the n sites of my system, so this will fix the variables here. And then these variables, spin variables, are connected to this hidden layer. So this hidden layer can be seen as an ensemble of effective spin, which interact with all of the other spins. So you have extremely long-ranged interactions between these hidden auxiliary variables and the actual physical variables. So that's the idea of this wave function. So if you write it from in a more formal way, you can write it like that. So it's just what I've written before, namely that you have these effective interactions. So these are your variational parameters now, which are this coupling between the hidden variables and the actual spin variables. And also you have some other few other variational parameters, which basically tell you how the neural network will react when you give it some given specific spin configuration. And the important point is that you can increase the accuracy of this object, of this neural network, upon adding more and more hidden variables, upon adding more and more neurons in your description. So this is the very important point, I would say, that you have a systematic way of increasing the accuracy and the amount of correlations you can put in your wave function, adding more and more neurons in your wave function. So that's the important point. And in particular, the accuracy will be then increased adjusting this what I call alpha, which is the density of the hidden variables, so the number of hidden variables over the number of actual spins. Also an important point is that there are some representability theorems which guarantee that this way of writing in a high dimensional function will eventually converge when alpha is large to the actual true function that you want to approximate. So this is an important result because it somehow guarantees us that we can approximate the wave function.
Do you have a more physical
theorem? So now what we can do now is that just to use our technology, variational technology that we had before. So we want to basically do what we did with the other states, but with these new states. And in particular, we want to like to sample at each time our wave function, the square models of the wave function, then obtain, for example, the average energy or the quantities that enter the TVMC equation of motion, and then update the network parameters, and then go to the next step. So this is, if you want, the equivalent of playing Go with our neural network. I will show you now quickly some results we obtained with these states. So these are results which have been obtained, for example, on the Heisenberg model in 1D. And you can see, I show you here the behavior, the energy as a function of the number of iterations in this approach, in this stochastic approach to optimize the energy. And you can see that basically when you increase alpha, okay, you cannot see from this plot, but basically everything converges to the exact result. And probably it's more clear here that when you increase alpha, for example, this is alpha equal 2, and go to from 2 to 4, I mean, you immediately gain a lot of accuracy in the ground state energy. So we've systematically seen that whenever you increase alpha, you can improve the accuracy of your ground state wave function.
Is this on a finite system or?
Yes, this is a finite system of, I think, 80 spins. In this
and
case,
the
line is obtained with the MRG.
Yeah.
Here I have like a systematic comparison of the accuracy we reach as a function of alpha on the ground state energy for a couple of models, both in 1D and in 2D. For example, in 1D. For the transverse field is a model where you can obtain the exact solution analytically, more or less. You can see that, again, you have typically a power law behavior in the way this thing converges. So the error, this is the relative error on the ground state energy. And you can see that when you increase alpha, you go to smaller and smaller values of this relative error. And also, you can see that the hardest to learn system is the one at the critical point, so at h equal 1, which makes sense. It's the point where you have the longest range of correlations, etc. But you can see here that even with just a small value of alpha equal to 4, you can already reach some 10 to the minus 5 or something accuracy in the energy. Also, you can compare this thing. You can do the same thing for the Heisenberg model. And you can see that, again, you have some systematic improvement. You can go to some a few 10 to the minus 6 with alpha equal 4. And you can really find systematically the ground state of this model. And you can improve, for example, this Jastrow-Feinberg state with the two-body answers that I've shown you before by several orders of magnitude in this case. A very important point is that, of course, you can use this approach also in two dimensions. For example, we tried in this first work on the 2D Heisenberg model and compared it with, let's say, state-of-the-art results for finite clusters, in particular obtained with the PEPS approach, so the projected entangled states. And this EPS approach, which is another class of states, these entangled packet states, which also are rather accurate on finite systems. And again, what we found is that when we increase alpha, we can improve systematically the accuracy. And at some point, we basically go, we improve systematically the accuracy of the best existing variational results up to date. So
is this again for a finite system or for an infinite or what?
This is again for a finite system. So that's why I compare with PEPS and not PEPS, IPEPS.
Okay.
And the exact result is QMC?
The exact result is stochastic series expansion QMC. with an error with another bar, which is of the order 10 to the minus 4. Otherwise, this comparison wouldn't make sense. Another important point, which I believe it's very interesting from a general point of view, is the fact that typically the number of variational parameters you need, for example, in 1D to represent with this accuracy the Eisenberg model, are typically much less than the ones you need with the corresponding MPS. So the corresponding magnetic polar state with the same accuracy typically would have a rather larger number of variational parameters if you consider the effective the bond dimension that you need to obtain the same precision. So this points to the fact that this representation of the ground state might be effectively more compact than the magnetic polar states.
When you're comparing to the Jastrow effect, I mean, there you're fixing your variational parameters. I mean, have you looked at the scaling for the Jastrow versus this?
So this is for 80 spins again, and if you do it for 40, it's the same.
No, I mean scaling number of variational parameters. So you're comparing a fixed number of variational parameters.
Yeah, sure. So this is the two-body Jastrow factor, if you want.
Because you can systematically.
The free body would be somewhere here, let's say, more or less.
I'm wondering, have you done the scaling, for example, looking as you scale the number of variational parameters in Jastrow versus your...
So the number of variational parameters that I have in this neural network ansatz scales like, in the variational, in the translational invariant case, like L, so the number of sites. It's linear in the number of sites. And the same goes for the Jastrow ansatz.
Right, but as you increase alpha, you're increasing...
The prefactor.
Right.
So in this case, I have 4L variational parameters, whereas in the Jastrow case, I would have only L. Yeah, so there's a factor of 4 if you want at alpha equal 4. Yeah. You can see how this connectivity matrix for the wave function looks like. For example, you can see interesting features in the 2D case. You can see that the neural network has learned about antiferromagnetic correlations in the Eisenberg model. You can also see that for some reason, which is not still very clear, that in 1D, the Eisenberg model instead has some more long-range correlations.
What's plotted on the right side? I can read the inside, like
which
the Heisenberg. What's plotted there? The plot on the right, the Heisenberg.
This one.
Yeah. What is this?
So these are the connectivity matrix.
What?
This is a
okay.
Yeah. That's V okay, yeah. W1, W2, okay. W3. So you have this is for alpha 16. You have 16 matrices basically that act on each spin configuration as filters. Mm-hmm. So they basically act on some spin, two-dimensional spin configuration, and they isolate some important correlations, some important features of your wave function, of your configuration. So for example, this thing acts, for example, as a correlator between at sites at a distance of 2, and sees if they are both, they have opposite spin magnetization. We've done the same game for quantum dynamics in 1D, and we compared here with for quenches in the transverse field Ising model or in the Eisenberg model. These results are for fixed alpha, so alpha equals 4. And already you can see that the agreement we find, apart from some isolated points, is rather good and can be improved upon increasing alpha. So again, we have also a way of systematically studying the dynamics and improving the accuracy that we have also for the dynamics in the 1D, but in principle also in two-dimensional systems. So I'm moving to the end, to the conclusions, and in particular, why these states work. So at the moment, the intuition I have is twofold. So one hand, it might be because basically nature likes simple things. So in other words, it's true that the Hilbert space, which describes a given quantum state, quantum system, is an infinitely large space, and there can be a lot of states which are very hard to describe with a simple analytic function, if you want. However, it's also true that if the state instead is the ground state, for example, some simple, relatively simple Hamiltonian, then reasonably the number of features that this state will carry will be somehow limited. So in this sense, what neural networks do is to effectively capture and identify these essential features of the wave function. And that's the reason why I believe these states work so well. Also, another important point is that these neural network quantum states have long-range correlations. So as I was saying before, you can have that these network weights are long-ranged in principle. And so this means also that these states are therefore suitable to describe, for example, critical phases in more or less any arbitrary dimension. And also, they might be also more compact in describing even gapped phase with respect to other states which are still intrinsically local. So these are, at the moment, the two ways I understand why these states work. So so that's my final slide. I've described to you the general framework to study the unitary time evolution with some correlated states in arbitrary dimension and also in continuous space. And this framework is this time-dependent variational Monte Carlo that we introduced in 2011. I've shown you that already upon using these Jastrom-Fieberg states, one can already obtain rather accurate results for the dynamics of high-dimensional systems, or in particular in two dimensions, but also for continuous space models, so the Liebliger case I've shown to you. And also there are some things that can be done for adiabatic quantum computing for a large number of qubits. I didn't have time to discuss about that, but you can be assured that if you want to study adiabatic quantum computing and study the time evolution induced by some time-dependent Hamiltonian, you can also use this approach, and you can simulate a large number of qubits, which otherwise you cannot do with other approaches. And finally, I've discussed about these neural network quantum states, which, in my opinion, are really a new powerful tool to solve both ground state and dynamics problems of strongly interacting quantum systems. They are a really promising tool to do that, since they can achieve, it seems, an accurate description and an arbitrarily accurate description of these states. And for example, in the case of the one-dimensional Heisenberg model, which is described by the Betti-Ansatz solution, I would say that it learned the Betti-Ansatz much faster than I ever did. I mean, like with four neurons, basically it learned the Betti-Ansatz, whereas with many more neurons, I had more problems in learning the Betti-Ansatz in my career. And also, they represent a controlled approximation in the sense that, as I was saying, you can make it smarter, so you can add more and more hidden neurons and increase the accuracy of your wave function. As I was saying, and I think this is a great challenge for quantum information, it would be interesting to understand why these states are accurate and why they can actually describe these states apparently with a number of parameters which is smaller than the ones that you need in a matrix product state. So this is a very interesting challenge, I believe, for people, if there are any in the audience that work in quantum information, because it's not clear, for example, to me that entanglement is really what matters for these states, which are intrinsically non-local. So it would be interesting to understand instead if we could have a different measure of the accuracy of these states, which is not based on entanglement, but on other properties of the wave function. For example, typicality of the states that you want to describe. So that's more or less it. There is, of course, a lot of things I haven't had the time to discuss in detail, but if you want, I'm really willing to answer your questions now or later. And thank you for your attention.
Questions or comments?
So can we target excited states with the neural network ansatz?
Yes, if you know the symmetries of the states, I would say yes.
So what about some state at some arbitrary energy? Like I'm thinking of many body localization, for example. And
um, Probably yes, because you would simulate then. I mean, basically everything you can do with the MPS, you can do with these things. So I mean, in principle. So if you have a way to do it with the MPS, which I believe you have probably, right, because you can target them with some shifted inverted approach. Probably you can do it also in this case. You can simulate the dynamics of this effective Hamilton. Resolve and if you want. But I have never done it, so that's an educated guess.
Yeah, so you mentioned that currently you're doing sort of a two-layer neural net where you've got the hidden variables and you've got your...
Yeah, so that's the current architecture I'm using.
Can you comment on, like, are these layers fully connected, and do you have plans to do more, hidden layers in the future?
So this layer, this the visible layer is fully connected, yeah, with this hidden one. And there are certainly plans to do other architectures, because in principle there's no reason why this one should be the best one to describe a physical system.
How is that going to change the way that you're sort of parameterizing the state? Like in the next slide, I believe you were talking about summing over the hidden variables. Yeah, this one here.
So the only thing I need to use my variational approach with these states is that I can, given a spin configuration, you should be able to tell me what's the value of the wave function immediately, let's say more or less immediately, without sampling on these hidden variables. So for the previous architecture, you can do this this sum explicitly, because the hidden variables are non-interacting among themselves. That's why I choose it. So, but in principle, any other architecture where you don't have to sample over the hidden variables, it's fine. Because if you want to sample over hidden variables, you can find that you can have the same problem, because these weights are complex in general.
So, I have a question. Is there any, like, in all these things that you showed, for example, for the time evolution, when does your method actually fail?
In which case?
I don't know. For example, in the time evolution,
For the neural networks,
yeah,
or for
no, let's say the variational Monte Carlo.
So okay. So for example, in the Hubbard model,
yeah.
In 1D, if you include only two-body density correlations in your wave function, it fails.
You mean in the ground state or in the time?
In the time evolution.
Is there a time? But my question is: given any number of parameters, is there a time up to which it's accurate, and after that it's no more accurate?
You can monitor that looking at the equivalent of the truncation error for the MRG that they can also measure.
So is it still, I guess, but I'm not sure, is it still like the time at which this thing gets accurate?
Yeah.
Scales exponentially. Oh, sorry, the other way around. The number of parameters, you have to add an exponentially more number of parameters to get a linear increase in the time. Is this correct? For example, still?
I'm not sure it's exponential in the number of parameters you have to add.
But what do you mean by the number of parameters? Do you mean like the number of n body terms? I mean, do you have to keep increasing n linearly or exponentially?
So, no, what I'm thinking of is, given a number of parameters in your variational wave function, there should be a time up to which it's accurate.
Yeah, that depends.
After that, there should be a time where it's no more accurate, like, or there, a transition time where you can, before that it's very accurate, after that it's not accurate. And that transition time, how does that scale with the number of parameters?
It's hard to say, because it depends on the problem. So for specific problem, you should really look at the truncation and see what happens. Because there are cases where these two-body answers, for example, is exact even for the dynamics. So this time is infinite, basically. So it really depends on the specific problem, obviously. But you have a systematic way of controlling that, either looking at the truncation error, or if you want, adding extra terms and seeing how the dynamics changes. So you can have an idea of where your previous answers failed start when you see that the more accurate one deviates from the previous one.
Okay.
And I would say that roughly for what I tried with this neural network quantum states, it is more or less linear in alpha, the time you need.
Okay, so again, what is it?
So the time at which fails, at which the answer starts failing, is the shortest when alpha is small, and if you want to push it farther, it scales more or less linearly with alpha. So if you double alpha,
you get twice as long.
Yeah, really? More or less. Yeah.
How does the computational time scale with alpha?
It's L squared. So it's alpha L squared, the overall computational cost.
Does it mean you can efficiently simulate quantum systems time evolution?
Well, yes, but still I'm limited to, let's say, a few hundred spins, hundred sites at the moment, because this implementation is not at all, it doesn't take into account like the latest developments in the neural network community. I don't use GPUs, I don't use any of that. And I'm pretty sure that with some more clever implementation, this thing can be pushed to much larger systems. So neural networks can be used to like recognize images which like have thousands of spins, of bits. So I'm pretty sure that these improvements can be used also in this field.
So along those lines, in terms of this truncation there, is your claim that your representability theorem say that you'll always, for generic variational ansatz, you might just be missing some correlations, and so you can, if you try to systematically increase your variational parameters, you might claim it's converged, but that's just because you have a bad variational ansatz. So is the claim here that this is sufficiently general that you won't ever run into that issue, that because any time, as long as you.
Well, let's say that this representability theorem tells you that if you increase alpha exponentially, then it's fine. You will represent anything. But of course, this cannot tell you if any polynomial increase of alpha will give you a good representation of what you want to represent. But on the other hand, if you are interested in ground state properties, you can monitor, for example, the energy variance and see if it goes to zero when you increase alpha. So if it does not, you can be fairly sure that then you have problems with your answers, that you're not describing the full correlations you need. So both for the dynamics and the ground state problems, you have self-consistency checks. So the energy variance for the ground state and this truncation error for the dynamics. So if they do not improve, then it means that probably, you're right. But at the moment, I've not found this kind of problems, but for the fact that I'm limited in some cases. For example, in the Heisenberg model, you can see that the convergence is not perfect here in 2D. I would expect like a straight line here, but the point, for example, these points at large alpha are harder to optimize. It's not that the ansatz is not does not capture all the correlations in it, but the fact that you have a stochastic way of optimizing it does not always guarantee that you find the optimal solution. So in a way, you are transformed an NP complete problem, which is solving the Schrödinger equation, to another NP complete problem, which is optimizing these parameters. But the point is that this can be more efficient than solving the actual Schrödinger equation. But it's not. There's no free lunch. So this can be hard as well. Right?
In the ground state, can you represent power law decaying correlations or law?
That's good. I didn't.
What about power law decaying correlations in the ground state?
I would say that this case, right, has a power law decaying correlations, or this one too, right?
Yeah.
They're both critical.
But is it like a bind having critical NPS on, like, it's not really critical, but if you look far enough, you will see that it's just a sum of exponent, or is it like...
No, it's like, I would say it's really long range, because as I was saying, these states are really long range. Sorry. So, okay. But for example, this pin is really, can interact with this one, because this is a fully connected model. So you have everything interacts with everything, the effective model. So in principle, they can be really long range.
Did you try to extract any critical exponents?
With these answers, no, but no. But with, for example, with the just of answers, I've done it, and there you certainly know that the thing is long range. Yeah, I mean, I'm fairly sure that this thing captures all the critical properties. But yeah, okay, this has to be checked, of course. But yeah.
Any other question or comments? Well, if not, Giuseppe is going to be here until Thursday, right? Until what time on Thursday?
In the morning, I believe.
Okay, so
let's say tomorrow is the last day.
He's going to be here. His office is
yours.
My office. So you can come and talk to him anytime if you're interested. All right, so let's thank Giuseppe again.
Thank you.